Land tax, stamp duty, tenants. Sure, property is great, but there are easier ways to get your passive income, sometimes with franking credits. Through ETFs or exchange-traded funds, you can buy a basket of shares in many different companies in one trade. BetaShares offers Australia's broadest range of ETFs, including income-focused funds, which aim to provide yield-hungry investors with attractive income streams. Discover the BetaShares range of ETFs and how simple they can be to invest in by going to betashares.com.au. Read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Wargent, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing. G'day, welcome to the Australian Property Podcast. This is our 2 cent segment that we do every Sunday morning for you. And I'm Pete Wargent from Allen Wargent Property Buyers. And I'm joined, as I am every week, by Chris Bates from Flint Group. Chris, how's your week been and how are you doing?
Well, we're recording it a bit earlier this week, aren't we, Pete? It's 9 a.m. on a Monday morning. Liverpool's just got a draw against Manchester City. So I think Yeah, I've been more nervous around that than lots of things in life at the moment, but we snuffed that draw in there. My daughter had a successful 4-year-old birthday party on the weekend. We got picture perfect weather down at Clareville Beach on the beaches, which was amazing. And yeah, things are settling at work. It's we've only launched basically a month ago now, 3 or 4 weeks, and we're really starting to everyone's starting to get in sorted in their new roles. A whole lot of new clients coming to us, so it's been exciting times and challenging, but we're coming out the other side. What's been keeping you busy, Pete?
I saw the Liverpool result. We don't want to fall into that blokey trap of talking about sport every week, but there was a bit of a howler on the penalty there to gift the equaliser. But I think from a neutral's perspective, it keeps it pretty exciting because any one of those top three teams could win the Premier League this year.
Absolutely.
So it always keeps the Brits interested in their cold March mornings. And good weekend for Spurs as well. Actually, on the sporting theme, it was the first round or the opening round of the AFL this week. So we went down to watch the Lions agonising 1-point defeat to Carlton this week. But it's such a good sport. Having watched a lot of sport over the years and, dare I say, decades, there's nothing really that gets much more exciting than a 1-point deficit with a minute to go in AFL. Yeah. It's absolute mayhem when it gets down to that. We had the same thing in the grand final last year. It's just a bit much for the kids, when it goes down to that and you've got 40,000 people going completely nuts. But I think they do so well on the AFL in Australia just to make it family friendly and the kids can go on the pitch and there's all kinds of things to keep them entertained. It's a very good family sport.
And what else has been happening on the work front, Pete? It seems that we're getting interstate migration coming up more and more. It's I can really feel it. And Queensland's, to be honest, where a lot of them do want to go. So you must be seeing that. You must be seeing a bit of that urgency from particularly interstate or maybe expats moving back. Which you probably haven't seen late last year. Can you notice a trend?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just as an anecdote for you, we went to a cafe in a place called Doonan, which is just 10 minutes outside of Noosa, I guess. And I know you're up in Noosa yourself this week, like every other southerner in the country. We just went to a cafe, Flying West, which is one of a number of these businesses where there's a warehouse and a coffee roastery with a cafe attached to it. And that's a big cafe inside, and they've got a stack of outdoor seating as well. You just could not get a seat, absolutely rammed. But I guess my just observation, just looking at the demographics, it's an awful lot of people in that sort of 50 to 60 age range, very sort of affluent. And yeah, you can just feel the Sydney and Melbourne vibe, really. And that's been the story for the Sunshine Coast over the past, I guess, 10 years, really. Like, people moving up from Sydney and Melbourne, other parts of the country. And yeah, there's definitely an interstate trend towards Brisbane, but it kind of flows up and down the coast as well, from Noosa all the way down, I guess, to Coolangatta and actually to the north coast of New South Wales as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people naturally went in 2020 to Byron. Everyone talked about Byron in 2020. And then when they got pushed out, they went to Kingscliff or Pottsville or Carburetor Beach, or they went to the Gold Coast or went Brisbane or Sunshine Coast, etc. And I think that's it. But people do like to hug the coastline, right? So they do like to stay within a few kilometres of it. They don't want to be, you know, 15, 20-minute drive away. It's sort of, you know, defeats the purpose of moving up there. So it's not like everything up there is probably going up at the same rate. The real scarce properties, the stuff that's walking to the beach, is beating to a different drum. You're right, Pete. I'm up in Noosa this week. We switched aggregators at work from Connective to AFG, the two biggest players, and we're at their strategic partners conference. So it's all their biggest practices. It's a very small cohort of their thousands of brokers. And yeah, so it should be interesting to see what they're all seeing on the ground. You know, ultimately, that's one of the benefits of these conferences, is that all these businesses are probably writing more than $1 billion, so you can, or up there anyway. And so they're seeing a lot of clients. So hopefully next week I've got a bit more chat to talk about. So what are we going to cover this week, Pete? Because there's a bit going on. You know, on the weekend, Monday morning, 9 a.m. That's why we're so fresh. But I mean, auction clearance rates were pretty strong. Not that I focus on that personally too much. I sort of don't get overly excited by it, but it does show there's some still heat in the market, which is what we've seen. We had a number of clients buy on the weekend. But what are the three stories we're going to do this week, Pete?
Sure, I've actually had a couple of conversations myself this week about people relocating from Sydney with decent budgets, been thinking about buying a place to live. But as you said, if you can get in close to the beaches, or if you can get somewhere with a water view, those markets are, you know, they tend to have a different cycle, I think. You know, the scarcity factor of having a water view or being so close to a beach, even if it's outside of the capital cities, that tends to have a real, it's just a scarcity value that the other properties don't. And it's worth spending to get the right location, even if the house needs some work. Big three stories this week. So ABS put out a nice little bullet point summary of the national accounts, 11 things that happened in the December quarter, which was quite a nice little summary and some good insights there. So we'll take a look. Secondly, lending slowdown in January. So it goes against a little bit what you might have expected to see. I think there's some factors there in terms of home loan processing times, and there's definitely been another slowdown in lending for new homes and for construction. I think there's still some cash buyers around for new property, but lending is slowing there. So we'll have a little deep dive on that. And then thirdly, AFRPs, Gen Z, or Gen Z, as I might say, as an Anglophile, Gen Z women fall behind on home ownership. So yeah, I think generally in Australia, home ownership rates are actually higher in the female cohorts, but not in Generation Z or Z, depending on your preference. So we'll take a look at why that's the case. So let's start with this first story. So we're kind of a week out of date here almost with the national accounts, but the ABS put out a neat little summary, 11 things that happened during the December quarter. So I guess let's just run through a few of them. So, I mean, growth in the economy slowed in the final quarter of 2023, and that was the trend all the way through 2023. So each quarter slower than the previous one, and all the way down to 0.2% growth. So still positive, largely driven by mining, which is doing very well, especially exports. And there's still a lot of government spending happening. But if you adjust that per capita, we've got very big or very strong population growth. So in per capita terms, we're really going backwards now. Obviously, rising interest rates are hurting. Households are cutting back on their spending. Many of them are running down their savings buffers. And the economy is sort of kept positive really just by government spending and mining exports. Now, I think, I guess in the end, this is what the rising interest rates were designed to do, to cool the economy and bring down inflation. And I saw Sally Auld from JB Weir was kind of saying, well, the interest rate sectors or interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy have slowed as designed and as expected. But I guess a part of that, as it relates to the housing market, is that we're not building much either. So we've got very big population growth. And at a time when actually housing construction or dwelling investment is really falling away.
Yeah, I mean, when you read through the points, the links in the show notes, I mean, it's kind of what you'd want to happen if you were the government at the moment. GDP slowing, inflation slowing, you know, wages are still going up, but, you know, they're not going through the roof. So I'm not getting this wage price spiral. Unemployment's going up. That's what we want, but it's not going up, you know, dramatically. I mean, 3.9, it's still pretty low. We're working harder, right? Our productivity is going up, which makes sense, right? Because people are a little bit more fearful of their jobs. And, you know, I do think they're working a little bit harder, which is great for our economy. Obviously, our savings is getting absolutely smashed. Our cost of living, our wages aren't keeping up with that. We haven't got much left over. We've got to pay our mortgages. And going into this situation is we saved really hard in COVID, plus the government gave us lots of free kicks. Build up our buffers. So we went into this high interest rate environment, probably more cash than ever, right? I think the consumption's absolutely dropping. Chatting to some friends in retail, some friends in hospitality. Everyone said Feb slow, you know, it's been really slow. It's this time of year, it's always slow. Everyone's overspent in January. There was quite a negative sentiment. So I sort of think that sort of makes a lot of sense as well. And it made a interesting point here. Travelers have, you know, going for the cheaper options in 2024 rather than if you're on Instagram, everyone was in Europe in 2023, right? And it said everyone's going to New Zealand and Bali, but I'm actually one of them. We booked some flights to Bali for a couple of weeks in June and we avoided the European holiday. Saying that, Bali's not that cheap when you add up the four kids and the flights and then you got the accommodation. It's not a cheap holiday. So, any other points that surprised you, Pete? I mean, you know, the business is continuing to invest, but I don't think businesses are going all at it, right? We're not just because, you know, there is uncertainty, right, coming in the next couple of years. So you don't really want to invest. You know, you've got to be gutsy to invest in these down cycles, right? That's usually the best time to invest, but businesses aren't usually that gutsy.
I think so. I mean, those household savings figures, they calculate a ratio, but it's really a derived figure. And interest paid on mortgages rose by 5% because borrowers are still coming off fixed rate loans late last year. I think, though, by the time you factor in things like mortgage repayments, superannuation contributions, which are up and down through the cycles, the savings ratio for a lot of people, a lot of households is negative, and those buffers are being run down. Of course, it's never a smooth distribution across the economy. Some people are doing a lot better than others. I think if you look at the growth in the economy per capita, it's done more or less what a lot of people predicted, which is almost like a square root shape. We got the big drop during the lockdowns, then we came booming back, and now we're almost just sort of heading back to the long-term trend now. So the economy per capita is, contracted by about 1% over 2023. Interest rates doing what they're expected to do. I think periodically you do get these debates in Australia about, well, we're just a quarry, you know, it's just mining. But and these figures kind of do give a bit of ammunition to that because it was, you know, the net exports that have kept the GDP positive. But I think if you take a step back, I mean, we also have great universities, which is another contentious issue. Tourism is picking up again. Healthcare is a huge part of the economy these days and the biggest employer. Construction, we've got a big infrastructure pipeline building up. So there's that part of the economy. Then we've got financial services and insurance and da da da. I think, you know, you can always make the argument that, well, if you take out mining, oh, and if you take out housing, and if you take out tourism, you know, then the economy would be rubbish. But I guess you have to work with what we've got. And for Australia, the competitive advantage, largely mineral wealth, higher education is a big one. I think I saw Constantine Kissin was presenting at Sydney Uni this week. And obviously, you know, that's a sort of contentious character in progressive circles. But the point he makes about, you know, people generally want to come to countries like Australia because prosperity, generally people have safety, we've got democracy. There's a lot of things about the system that Australia has that is appealing to people, especially aspirational people from other countries. And I think sometimes in a dismissive way that we say, oh, well, it's just that, you know, we're just a mining country and, you know, we're just effectively a quarry with universities. Well, there's a lot more to Australia than that. And I think sometimes we don't recognise it because we're here.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's interesting, one of the charts here, I love it. Hopefully people can see it if they're playing along at home. But, you know, our GDP growth over the last, 20 years, and just the impact that our high migration does to our actual GDP growth. And our GDP capita growth has actually been pretty bad, right? So I think it adds a couple of percent a year. And so, I think that's a bit concerning when you look at countries around the world, right? They'll be saying, well, you guys are only growing because you import lots of people. What's your take on that story, Pete?
I think there's two parts to it. The early 2000s, when the mining boom kicked off, GDP per capita was very strong. And in fact, the economy was too high, if you remember, running up to 2006, 2007. Then the resources construction boom peaked around 2012. But it seemed that even though the higher migration figures were very justified in the early phases of the mining boom, because we needed people to come and work in the mines and to build these big projects. But the immigration, we almost got addicted to and just carried on. And a lot of it's international students, as we've touched on. And we've kind of somehow got addicted to the high levels of population growth. I think a lot of developed countries have gone down this route, though. Canada, UK, New Zealand, the US to some degree. And I think it's partly an acknowledgement of an aging population. And if we can get younger people in, then that defers that problem for another day. You know, it keeps the tax take high. It grows the economy, at least at the headline level. But it does have some issues. We've got a lot of pressure on infrastructure, a lot of pressure on housing. Dwelling investment is falling at a time when population grows very high. So, yeah, it does sort of paper over the cracks a little bit, high immigration, because in per capita terms, 2023 wasn't great.
Yeah. Oh, let's go on to story two, Pete. I mean, lending data. I mean, always as a broker in a broking business, I feel like I always watch these numbers and go, yeah, it sort of aligns to what we're seeing, and sometimes it doesn't. So, what's your take on this article, Pete?
It was a strange one, wasn't it? So in January, lending for housing fell 3.9%. Now, of course, these monthly figures, they do bounce around with all of these series, actually, and that's why sometimes better off to watch the trend rather than the monthly noise. But fewer owner-occupiers approved in January 2024. So there's a couple of factors here. Processing times had sped up, and I wonder if some of it was pulled forward. But in particular, lending for new housing and construction is falling again. It's back down close to record lows. So lending for housing is one big blob, you know, one big number. And certainly the Gold Coast, we're seeing some examples of apartment projects getting up. But generally, lending for new housing has been very weak. It's pretty much as low as it's been. So that's a factor itself. What are you finding for processing times? Have you seen volumes drop off, or do you think this is just noise?
Oh, I do think it's a bit of noise, right? So investor or loan book growth is really hard right now because of how tight borrowing capacities are. And so you're going to see very poor numbers in terms of credit growth just because people can't leverage up, right? It's really restrictive what people can borrow. And I think that's going to lead into a real pressure on, you know, APRA relaxing their servicing, you know, buffers, and, you know, try to increase borrowing capacities. You've got the rate tax cuts coming through. And so I think and the banks are really talking about, hey, the haves and have nots. It's coming out more and more. There's a mortgage war happening again. So there was an article that came out over the weekend that bank pricing's getting tighter. That's absolutely the case. It's been a I guess the banks have kind of taken the foot off the pedal a little bit from sort of mid-2023. You know, if you were repricing your loan early 2023, those discounts weren't getting achieved again all the way through the later half of last year and early this year. And I think it's coming back. We've started to see some really strong pricing the last couple of weeks. And the banks, you've got to thank mortgage brokers for this. I know I'm one, so I'm sort of very biased, but ultimately the banks know if they don't have strong pricing, their loan book growth really slows down. So CBA pulled out of the market and then all of a sudden they start growing lower than system or lower than what their competitors are. Their market share starts dropping. Yes, their net interest margin goes up because they're doing loans that are more profitable, but then at some point they say, well, yeah, you're doing more loans that are profitable. We're actually losing market share. And then all of a sudden they have to come back really strong with pricing because brokers have want to get the best deal and have options. They're more comfortable dealing with lots of different banks. And so if this bank's not offering the best deal, then someone else will fight for that customer. And so I would say there's that. I mean, I quickly had it brought up the monthly CoreLogic results, which I don't actually think they're on their website. I just happened to find them. Maybe they're publishing them today, but I found them. And you can see sales volumes are really down. So not only are we not, it's credit growth really tight and new homes not happening, but we're just not selling as much. We're not transacting. And that's been a real problem. I mean, I know it looks better than it was, say, 12 months ago, but I would say it's still, really, really tight. I would say the pre-approvals are there. Bank servicing times are pretty good right now. So you can get loans through and credit aren't playing too much of a back and forth game. So the article sort of alluded to that banks had approved a lot more loans in January. And so February looks worse than it is because there was better processing times. But ultimately, I would just say, credit growth is sort of tight because of all these factors. But I wouldn't read too much into it. I think the demand's there. The pre-approvals are there and people are wanting to buy. It's just the numbers don't show that.
I think when you've got low stock levels, you do get this thing where people get a bit scared to sell or transact because there's just this fear if you sell your home and you can't find somewhere to move to, you get trapped and you're stuck out of the market, then you might have to rent for a while and that comes at its own cost. Then you might have to move twice and it can just knock down those turnover figures a little bit. I actually got asked to write an article for Rich Harvey, a property buyer, about a week or so ago about should you sell before you buy or should you buy before you sell? And then you've got to think about bridging loans. And there's actually pros and cons to either approach. And a bit of it depends on how much debt you can service and your own personal circumstances. But whenever you get very low stock levels, it does make people twitchy about moving because they're just concerned that if they don't find the right place to move to, then they could really be stuck in a very tight rental market. So I think, yes, turnover's down and that's probably not helping. Interesting, Chris, you flicked me another article from John Kehoe at the AFR saying why the cost of living crisis is not so bad for home borrowers. And well, I'll quote from the article, Canberra-based Outlook Economics director Peter Downs says the cost of living crisis is exaggerated for home borrowers because typical nominal mortgage rates have tripled from about 2% to 6%, but the real or inflation-adjusted mortgage rate has gone from negative to about 2%, which is relatively low by historical standards. So to put that out of economist speak and into plain English, what he's saying is that basically if you've had a mortgage over the past few years, yes, your cash flow has been impacted, but most people have done pretty well over that period. Your debt's getting inflated away, your asset values have gone up. And I think this is something we spoke about maybe a week or two ago, that over the long run, if you've got a mortgage and there's periods like we've had inflation at 8% in Australia, then effectively the value of that mortgage is getting inflated away over time. I think there's another side to this argument though, and the ABS figures showed it, and that is that from a cash flow perspective, a lot of households are getting rogered, basically, for want of a better phrase. So I think, yes, if you're managing your cash flows well, it's great because the debt's getting inflated away, your asset values have gone up, but I think we shouldn't overlook as well, though, that for a lot of households, there's been some hardship and it is difficult from a cash flow point of view to stay in the market through that period.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing to think about with this is that, households might be feeling more wealthier, but they don't realize it, but they probably are because their debt is getting inflated away at a high inflation rate. And so You know, $2 million of debt, you know, 3 years ago seemed a lot, but it's not $2 million today. You know, most likely wages have gone up, inflation's sort of eaten that away a bit. So over a few years, that doesn't sort of matter, you know, to you, but over the, say, 10, 20, 30 years, if you just paid interest only on your mortgage, this is an easy way to think about it, I think, is, and you just paid interest only on a mortgage for, say, 10, 20 years, well, and then you sold the property, well, you've got all that growth there right on top of that interest only. And, you know, and I think that that debt won't feel, $1 million in 20 years' time won't feel like $1 million today. And, you know, wages will be gone up. So it does matter though on an individual basis though, because if you've had really strong wage growth and your other cost of living haven't been jumping up, yeah, okay, your expenses and your cash flow is really eating into your situation at the moment, but that's getting offset by wage increases. So I do think it's going to be a real mixed bag for how wealthy a family's feeling. But if you're able to carry a debt through this period to a point when interest rates start to drop and inflation starts to drop as well, then you can sort of get that Goldilocks position at the end of it where that debt's no longer as big as it once was, and you've got the wage increases through that cycle to offset that. So you've come out the other side really strong. And I think that's what this article is sort of alluding to, that some families, even though they're going through high repayments and inflation's high, will come out the other side being more wealthy.
Absolutely. Before we move on and finish on this second story, just one extra observation from the guys at the Housing Industry Association. Always love their analysis. It's good stuff. About 4,000 loans, I guess, or thereabouts, for the purchase and construction of a new home. Just for context, it was over 12,000 during the home builder stimulus. And if you look back since, look over, say, two decades, normally you're getting about 5,000 to 6,000 loans for the purchase and construction of a new home. And now we're way below. So we're down about 9% over the past 3 months from a year earlier. So slowing, effectively. I think they just acknowledged that there's just one market that's moving out of sync from the rest, and that's Western Australia. So new home lending in WA was up 23% compared to the previous year. So yes, there's a construction cycle happening in Western Australia, but for Sydney, Melbourne, and now to some degree Brisbane, it's really dropped away and we're near record lows. So yeah, that's a worry. Interest rates are supposed to slow dwelling investment, but yeah, that's all well and good. But when you've got record high population growth, we need dwelling investment, and hopefully we're near the cycle lows now. So Chris, third and final story of the week. So this one was from the Australian Financial Review. Generation Z, women falling behind on home ownership. So overall, more women than men own property in Australia, which I guess it's partly because they're more willing to buy jointly than men. Looks like we've got a thunderstorm kicking off here in Noosa, just in time for your arrival, Chris. But there's things to factor in, like divorce rates are higher than they used to be. But the article suggested that some younger females and generations there are falling behind. And why is that? It's an interesting piece. So 68% of women own at least one property, including investment properties, which is higher than 67%. For men, but by contrast, only 27% under 30 do, compared to 51% of men, the survey shows. And that's Eliza Rowan, your friend from CoreLogic, who highlighted the challenges for younger female buyers. So interesting stats, because yes, overall home ownership's rates higher for women, but not for the younger cohort.
Yeah, so CoreLogic released this on International Women's Day, which is actually my daughter's birthday as well. So good day for her to be born on. But I actually interviewed Eliza on the elephants and we had a good chat about this. And yeah, we just wondered, you know, the desire was actually higher in women than men. So, you know, they wanted to own. A lot of men, women also thought that they didn't feel ready, but a lot of, and so they were getting themselves ready. They were, and maybe a little bit more conservative in terms of the way that they approach their investing and management of their money. There's been a lot of research around this over the years, and that women are better investors than men because a lot of them, they don't go into the gambling sort of mentality of trying to time markets and buying in and out and picking stocks and things like that. Which men are more likely to do that, whereas women are more sit and hold, and that over the longer term ends up being a better result most of the time. And so we sort of wondered if it was, you know, a lot of that mentality. Women are gathering the information, and when they do enter, they they get it right, whereas the manager's happy to get in and get anything. And so, but it's a big gap between, and this is sort of what she's highlighting, it's a big gap, you know, 51% of men 18 to 29 versus, you know, a quarter. So half versus a quarter. And that is a big gap. Whereas if you go to the next, you know, the next generation, right, the millennials, well, actually women own more. And then the next generation, women own more. I do think it's an interesting one. They're just starting a bit later. And maybe a lot of that is to do with work and families and not having the income and the professions they work in, maybe that, and the wage gap, you know, the reality. And so highlighting things like that are really important, because there is definitely a super problem between men and women, and that gets amplified through, you know, the baby stage and then divorces and things like that. And that gap in super is huge, but the home ownership gap doesn't probably get talked about as much. I would say, though, that the Gen Z generation is absolutely more self-educators than they were in, say, my generation and the generations after. You've got some huge successful women-focused podcasts. She's on the Money is, you know, probably Australia's biggest business podcast. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people listen to her. Azaria Bell, I think she's got some good followers. And number one, Jess Brady, Melissa Brown. There's some amazing women that are giving, you know, financial sort of guidance and coaching and things like that. And so, yeah, I don't think they don't want to get educated and they don't want to buy property, because this article shows that. But maybe they're just a little bit slower than men than getting onto the market.
Yeah, shout out to Melissa Brown. I've done a couple of things, presentations and webinars and stuff with her over the years, and she's the real deal. You know, she knows her stuff inside out. It's not vibe-based. She's a highly qualified and successful individual. So let's quote Eliza a little bit from the article. So women's slight edge on property ownership overall could be attributed to their willingness to buy with other people. 53% of women have owned property with other people compared to 52% of men. And women are also more motivated in the surveys. But yes, Gen Z females 18 to 29 had the lowest share of home ownership at just 27%. Baby boomers was highest at 83%. Interesting, just a little stat here. The barrier for younger women appeared to be related to financial issues rather than a reluctance towards home ownership, Ms. Owen said. Gen Z overall women had lower income levels, 67,800 per year before tax, compared to males who earned 83,500 on average. So, I mean, that's obviously going to be a factor. If younger men are earning more, then the accessibility to getting on the ladder is going to come sooner. Any advice for younger would-be first home buyers, Chris?
I think there's a pressure to just get on the market, and society pressure. And I think maybe if I actually don't like that, to be honest. I think that people rush that decision. And maybe men are in this situation. Maybe they own, but maybe they don't own great properties. Maybe they bought a cheap investment property regionally that hasn't performed, or, you know, a cheaper apartment, because they just want to get something rather than just tick that box off, rather than maybe a little bit more subjective, taking their time, looking at the difference. So I think ultimately it's about the importance of, you know, property wealth within your overall wealth and retirement. And so I do think, but there's no pressure. Just to get something is sometimes, is often not better than having nothing, right? You can actually do better just having money in shares and saving versus buying an asset, paying stamp duty, paying selling costs, it not going up in value. And if you want to have any clarity on that, rather than just say anecdotally people, and you just naturally assume, oh, actually everything goes up in value, just download the CoreLogic Pain and Gain report and just see the stats, the amount of people that lose money on a dollar for dollar basis, let alone when you add in stamp duty and selling costs. And so I think a lot of people get burnt, particularly like Gen Zs and millennials have been burnt just trying to get onto the market and buying anything rather than trying to be a bit more slower and enter it properly and get a good asset. And so that would be my major advice. I mean, everything else you can sort of, you know, and just really understand lending. You know, sometimes you put restrictions on you. I've got to have a 20% deposit. You don't understand, you know, 5% deposit schemes, or, you know, LMI, or using a guarantor. So, you know, you sometimes you can enter the market and still be protected. You can, you know, have buffers. You can really understand your repayments. You can flat share post your purchase. You could maybe use a guarantor with parents. So you could be a bit crafty and hustle, and don't be afraid to ask your parents. Not everyone's in that fortunate position. I do find sometimes people who have got the ability to get help don't get help because they put their principles in front of that, even though they and then that maybe is an opportunity cost. So there's lots of probably in that question, Pete, to cover.
There sure is. So let's wrap up on those three stories this week. So 11 things that happened in the December quarter. Well, largely it's a slowing economy. Those higher mortgage rates are starting to bite on households. Spending is slowing and people are just hanging in there for the end of the interest rate cycle. Related story, lending defies growth hopes, declining in January. I think there's a bit of noise in there, but also lending for new homes and construction is at record lows or near enough, except in Perth and Western Australia. So we've got a real shortage of housing building up. And then third story, Gen Z women falling behind on home ownership. Easy for me to say, but bear in mind Chris's point, you're better off to focus on quality, not quantity. And it's not a race necessarily to get onto the ladder. You'd be better served to buy something that fits your purposes. Chris, as we started recording here, we had an absolute hurricane blowing through Noosa, but you'll be pleased to hear the sun is out, so calling you to the Sunshine Coast. So hopefully see you around the traps for a lime smoothie this week if you've got 5 minutes in your schedule.
Absolutely, Pete. We'll try to catch up, mate. And happy Sunday to everyone listening. Send your questions through and, we'd love to cover them in future episodes. And if you want to catch Pete, definitely be following his blog if you're not doing that. And in the show notes, you can get in contact with us and the team. We're still running under Blusk as we sort of do this transition to the new website. So, definitely still click that link in the show notes.
Yes, and the subject title, the episode title, is Australia just a quarry with decent universities? Look, to some level, yes, but there's a lot more to it than just that. And overall, as we've mentioned on other episodes, a victim of our own success to some level. It's just so much money and so much wealth sloshing around Australia these days that it can create challenges further down the chain, I think.
Absolutely. I think this intergenerational wealth, the budget's getting closer and we're going to start talking about that more and more over the next couple of months. And, I think there's going to be some big policies out there to try to target, housing affordability, a rental crisis, a mortgage crisis. It's, that sort of story starting to going to really pick up speed over the next couple of months, I believe.
Well, that's right. We're only a year out, really, from the next federal election. And, I think that home ownership is going to be a huge part of it in the rental market because the conservative side of politics, well, people only generally vote conservative if they've got something to conserve. And so both parties will be taking a very keen interest in housing policies and we'll track that on the podcast as we go along. So have a super weekend, everyone, and look forward to chatting next time.
Happy Sunday.
Thanks for tuning in to the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RASC podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player. to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the Rask Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.